Anya settled into the passenger seat. Beaming between his uniform collar and his peaked cap, Ten Bears put the cruiser back in gear and drove off along the country road at just over walking pace. She regarded him through narrowed, suspicious eyes.
Small world, huh?
Small world. Welcome to Indian country, Miss Creed. Not much goes on here that folks don't see. What they see, they like to talk about, especially when you're a wide-eyes from outside, and most especially, a real nice-looking lady wide-eyes, if you get my drift.
Anya knew full well that the coming of any stranger would spark gossip in a tight-knit community. While Anya didn't think of herself as particularly beautiful, she knew that her tall, lean-muscled, leggy form tended to attract added attention that, say, a dumpy 50-year-old bearded archaeologist would not.
I heard some things, got me kind of concerned. I checked your motel, but you weren't there. Them Comanche County deputies told me you'd left the dig site right around sundown, so I wondered if you hadn't broken down along the way, or something.
Or something, she thought, but carefully did not say.
The breakdown scenario. My rental car died on me. I just managed to ditch it in the parking lot of the Bad Medicine Bar.
Ho ho! Tell me you didn't go inside.
No cell phone coverage out there. I didn't think I had much choice. The reception I got didn't exactly make me feel welcome, so I left.
Oh, them boys rowdy you up some?
Let's say I got out of there before things got really out of hand.
Well, you're a big TV star and all. Anything happened to you, it'd reflect poorly on the department and the Comanche Nation. Also, you seem like a nice lady, if a bit idealistic.
Thanks, I think.
You see, there's something going on in Indian country. Mostly western Oklahoma and northern Texas. Something not so good. We got some people here. Young people who are kind of on the radical side.
He glanced at her.
You met some of them tonight. Iron Horse People Motorcycle Club.
I see.
Yeah, they got a rival bunch. Call themselves the Dog Society. Both sets want to live in the good old days, you know? Ride around, whooping and hollering and shooting buffalo. They don't much like the government. Okay, nobody does. They are also not too fond of the white eyes.
He drove a moment in silence. To their right, the land began to pitch up into rough granite hills. Ten Bears didn't seem to be in a hurry to get anywhere. That he was heading away from Lawton didn't particularly alarm Anya. She had fairly well-honed survival instincts. She didn't sense anything sketchy from Ten Bears, just concern. She knew he wasn't telling her everything. Police never told outsiders everything about a live investigation. It didn't mean much.
Most of all, they don't like each other. There's trouble between them. Regular trouble, lots of bad blood, and it's getting worse.
I don't ever see anything about this on the news.
I hope you don't, Ms. Creed.
Ten Bears looked at her.
I hope you won't be going public with it.
Not much danger of that. I'm an archaeologist, not a reporter.
Yeah, nation's trying to keep it all quiet. So's the state. The Comanche Nation's got this new casino opening up in a few days. You know, your young bloods, the radical traditional types, aren't happy about that. It's Indian business, and white eyes don't much care. Anyway, if word of the problem does get out, what with the whole continuing terror hysteria and all, it's just going to bring more grief to Indians without calming the passions that are causing the problems.
I understand.
Most people here are good folks. Indians, whites, blacks, Asians, whatever. But there are strong undercurrents of racism and anger in plenty of areas where white eyes aren't in the majority and not real popular, you know?
I got the impression.
Yeah. So why don't I give you a ride back to the motel? I'll talk to the car rental company. You can call them in the morning to retrieve your broke-down ride and get a new one. Better still, why not just fly on back to New York City, get yourself some nice arugula?
I'm not a big arugula fan, Lieutenant. I'm more the unabashed carnivore. I promise I won't interfere with your investigation. I'll do my best to keep from turning up on the news for any reason whatever. But I lost a good friend today. I'm not ready to pack it in and head home.
Anya turned away from him and wiped moisture from her cheek. The ghostly funhouse mirror image of her face looked back at her with exaggerated eyes. Snowflakes beat against the windows like suicidal moths bent on flame.
Well, I figured you'd take that line. Well, it was worth a try. Listen, the whole skinwalker angle is tough for a cop to approach, even a native cop. We're supposed to be close to the spirits and the earth and all that, but us Indians don't like to give our brother officers too many excuses to roll their eyes when they think we're not looking, you know? You want to give me a real leg up catching the party or parties who murdered your friend? I'd certainly be willing to look at any evidence you might turn up on that aspect of the case.
Thanks, Lieutenant.
No, don't thank me. I should probably lock you up or something. But if I could make a small suggestion, you might want to take a closer look at the earlier attacks, as in firsthand. They took place in what would seem more like Skinwalker country anyway.
Conveniently distancing myself from Comanche territory.
Exactly. I knew you were a smart lady.
I'm not too unhappy about making myself scarce for a while either, come to think of it.
If you want to pick up on some of the cultural backdrop, both on South Plains Indians and the Navajo, there's somebody I know you might want to talk to, since you'll be down Albuquerque way anyway.
That night, there was no mention at all on TV or online about anything at all happening at a lonely bar in the sticks of western Oklahoma. Nor was there any the next morning. In between, Anya slept like one dead. To Anya's complete surprise, the car rental agency not only failed to give her a molecule of grief when she called them the next morning to report her mishap, but they insisted she have a replacement without her even asking. They'd come pick her up. She suspected the jovial and heavy hand of one Lieutenant Tom Tenbears, OHP. As she neared her destination, the land rose and grew more broken, mounting to what Anya, with all respect to the Wichita Range, considered something closer to real mountains, with ridges and slopes densely furred with straight-poled pines. These, she knew, were the Sandias. Following her GPS, confirmed by reference to a Google Earth map she'd summoned in her motel room in Lawton the previous night, a few miles west of Grant's, Anya turned left down a none-too-obvious dirt road. It wound quickly upward between steep, scrub-covered hills into the Zuni Mountains, with their forests of ponderosa pine, along the Continental Divide. The first attack took place at a dig in the Cibola National Forest, working what was believed to be the remnants of an encampment of Warm Springs Chiricahua Apache, led by the great guerrilla master Victorio during his war with the U.S. In the 1870s, Native American groups protested the excavation, even though the Mescalero tribe, which incorporated most of the survivors of the various Chiricahua groups except the Mexican Chiricahua, who were still in Mexico, offered no objection. It lay in a steep-sided draw. A USDA team discovered the site while checking the results of reseeding by air after the area burned over in a 2004 fire. The attack occurred the previous autumn. No signs remained of the dig or the murders. The excavation got canceled after the incident. Wind and weather since smoothed out the disturbed earth. Anya found no great mystery as to how the attacker could have struck from ambush there, either. The site lay along one side of a dry stream bed, with the tree line beginning barely 20 yards away on one side and a rock outcropping looming 12 feet right above where, from the files, she knew the actual excavation took place. It would have taken a very athletic man to have dropped that distance without injuring himself. Then again, it also took a very athletic man to kill three able-bodied adults, two men and one woman, and fatally wound a third man. The sun was falling behind the divide as Anya drove back east. Although she still felt mostly numb about Paul's death, in between racking bouts of grief, she'd had a stressful couple of days. Not to denigrate the sheer physical toll long travel and combat took. She pulled off the highway just east of the river and spent the night at the Hotel Albuquerque on Rio Grande Boulevard, just north of Old Town. The second attack took place in early March on land owned by San Ildefonso Pueblo between Santa Fe and Albuquerque. The Pueblo itself invited a state team in to excavate what was believed to have been a temporary settlement by Pueblo Indians, sometime predating the Great Pueblo Uprising that threw the Spanish out in 1680. Despite that fact, and the fact that both State of New Mexico archaeologists and Pueblo experts confirmed the absence of human remains, the site once again drew protesters. An ugly confrontation broke out when Pueblo police removed them for trespassing, although there was no record of injuries nor charges filed. Apparently, there was some sentiment, in the Southwest at least, that any kind of archaeological excavation of potential Indian sites was profane. Although this massacre was just a few weeks old, Anya didn't learn anything new here either. As in the other two cases, a cautious approach could easily have gotten the killer in range for a final rush without being seen, especially since nobody would have been looking. Anya got back to Albuquerque about 2 o'clock and spent the rest of the afternoon, as she waited for her next appointment, going through local and national news accounts of the murders online at a coffee shop on a fairly rustic-looking section of Rio Grande Boulevard a few miles north of her hotel. The common threads among the murders, aside from the obvious gross similarities, were that they took place on dig sites that were protested by obscure groups. These had no apparent connection between themselves, other than professed radical pro-Native American sympathies. It wasn't even clear how many of the protesters were actually Indians themselves. She sat on the outdoor patio beneath a cottonwood beginning to leaf, drinking tea and pondering a few questions. Was the fact that all three attack sites had been protested significant or purely coincidental? If significant, what was the connection? Even the FBI, notoriously eager to discover terrorist conspiracies, either cleared the protesters of involvement or at least failed to list them as persons of interest. The light took on a late afternoon yellowness. The sun had gotten tangled in the branches of the massive old cottonwoods across the boulevard. Time to go, Anya told herself and folded her computer shut. The western sky blazed in orange like burning forests when the silver Prius pulled up to the curb by the park and stopped. A tall woman got out of the driver's side. A skinny young girl in jeans, t-shirt, and a yellow windbreaker, with her black hair in pigtails, got out of the passenger side. A big, floppy, yellow lab pup, an adolescent probably, spilled out after her.
You must be Dr. Watson!
Anya rose from the picnic table a short way down a grassy slope from the street as the woman walked toward her. She was handsome, if a bit heavy in face and hip, and the hair hanging unbound around the shoulders of her mauve cable-knit sweater was black with silver threads. She wore a long, dark blue denim skirt over dark purple suede boots with silver medallions on them.
Yes, and you're Anya Creed?
Yes.
The girl looked up from her dog.
And I'm Sally. It's short for salamander.
No, it isn't, Alessandra. Don't be untruthful.
Something about the girl's appearance tweaked Anya's subconscious. She couldn't pin down exactly what. The dog sniffed Anya's legs. She hunkered down to stroke its head.
What's his name, Sally?
It's a she. Her name's Erwin. She's kind of silly.
Young Labrador retrievers act that way. Why don't you and she go play?
The girl was looking intently at Anya.
You're on TV, aren't you?
Her mother looked stern.
Yes.
Oh, I like your show.
Thanks.
Sally reached in a pocket of her jacket and produced a pale green tennis ball, which she launched down the hill. The dog bounded in pursuit. Sally ran after her, romping through the shadows of big elm trees, lengthening across the hills of Roosevelt Park, which was located roughly halfway between the University of New Mexico campus, where Watson worked, and downtown.
Thanks for taking the time to meet with me, Dr. Watson.
Susan, please, I'm certainly willing to do anything I can to get to the bottom of these terrible crimes. And I thank you for being willing to meet with me under such unusual circumstances. I don't really have any free time at school this week, and I don't want to leave Sally at daycare longer than necessary.
She leaned forward and fixed Anya with a disconcertingly probing look. Even without the low boot heels, she had to stand 6 feet clear. Anya did not envy any student of Dr. Watson's who failed to measure up to her expectations.
So, is your interest in skinwalkers personal or professional?
Both. I lost a close personal friend in the last attack. Also, the authorities in Oklahoma have asked me unofficially to consult on certain anthropological aspects of the case.
You're an archaeologist by training, aren't you?
Yes. Of course, my training included extensive education in social and physical anthropology, as well as subjects like geology.
Oh, yes.
Watson herself was a professor of cultural anthropology at the University of New Mexico, specializing in the study of southwestern native cultures.
So, what can I do for you?
My specialty is the European Renaissance. It's a little far afield from the South Plains and the Rio Grande Valley. And to be perfectly honest, while we studied Native American history and cultures, my memory isn't as sharp as it could be.
I understand. I forgot all my geology pretty much the instant I turned in my last exam.
So, if you could fill me in a bit on the cultural background of the Southwest and Plains cultures, and any hint you can provide me as to why something out of Navajo folk belief would be operating in the Comanche country of western Oklahoma, would definitely be appreciated.
Well, to start with, the Indian cultures of North America didn't live in vacuums, much less isolation from one another.
Anya was only mildly surprised at a tenured professor using such a politically incorrect term as Indian. Very few Native Americans she'd ever met showed anything but the most strident contempt for the phrase Native American. Tom Ten Bears hadn't had much use for it either.
Even before the Europeans' arrival, my own people, the Kiowas, were especially famed for their roles as raiders and traders. Rather, as the Vikings were in Europe and even the Mediterranean, so were the Comanches, especially after the two nations allied in the late 18th century. Comanche relics have turned up in the Cahokia Mounds. Kiowa tradition recalls trading voyages to the country of the Maya, who were themselves noted for the long journeys of their own traders, who also served as proselytizers for their religion.
Really?
So the South Plains people were common visitors to New Mexico. What's now northeastern New Mexico was part of their customary range. In fact, sometimes the plains folk came to the pueblos to trade, sometimes to pillage and kill. It was the usual antagonism between settled groups and nomads.
I'm familiar with that. So where did the Navajos come in?
Originally as rivals. As an Apachean subgroup of the Athabascan peoples, they and their fellow Apacheans also raided the prosperous and populous riparian communities. That often brought them into conflict with the South Plains people. Usually, the Apache came off second best.
Anya noted a half-hidden grin at that. That was something she'd noticed in her dealings with people of Plains Indian extraction. No matter how vocally they tried, as many did, to disavow violence and war, they remained at core warrior cultures, and thoroughly proud of their histories.
It wasn't perfectly straightforward, of course.
Are human interactions ever?
Not that I've noticed.
Dr. Watson shook her head, seemed to go introspective for a moment.
A famous hide painting exists of a battle at about the time of the American Revolution between Spanish troops with Apache mercenaries and French ones alongside Comanche allies.
Who won?
The French and Comanche. I'm tempted to add, of course. Anyway, the contacts, if anything, grew stronger with the conclusion of the wars of Indian subjugation. After the final surrender of the Chiricahua Apaches to the U.S. Army in the 1880s, they were eventually shipped to Fort Sill in Oklahoma.
Which is the heart of Comanche territory.
Yes. About half the nation still lives around Sill and Lawton. Of course, by the time the Chiricahua gave up their relatives, the Navajo had long since come to terms with the inevitable and settled down to become sheep herders. Meanwhile, the Chiricahua had extensive exposure to Comanche culture on the reservation.
I didn't think there were any reservations in Oklahoma.
There aren't any more. It was the usual story. The free peoples of the plains kept being restricted to smaller and smaller chunks of less and less desirable real estate. Then, as soon as they got settled in, somebody would discover something on the land they'd been ceded, gold in the Black Hills, say, and they'd be pushed off again. In Oklahoma, the Kiowa and Comanche were both forcibly settled onto reservations, which were then whittled away to nothing. The last of the Kiowa were forced out for white settlement in 1901, the Comanche in 1906.
That's sad.
Yes, it is. Don't worry. I know you didn't do it.
So, what can you tell me about the Dog Society?
Originally a Cheyenne Warrior Society. One of six, actually.
Why would Comanche radicals be calling themselves after a Cheyenne group?
Well, you'd have to ask them. However, the dog soldiers were known for their extreme aggression. They were eventually outlawed and cast out of the Cheyenne tribe after one of their members murdered a fellow tribesman and formed their own band. That could be part of the attraction for violent radicals, that aggressive association.
I see. What I still don't understand, I'm afraid, is how and why someone evidently caught up in Navajo witchcraft would wind up committing murders in Oklahoma.
Again, I have no good explanation to give you. Such an individual would be very twisted by the standards of any human culture. Navajos, Athabascans, still take witchcraft with the utmost seriousness. It's the blackest evil to them. People accused of witchcraft still have a tendency to turn up dead. The Navajo wolf, or skinwalker, is basically the worst kind of witch. You can only gain that kind of power through extensive contact with the dead, something most of the Southwest Indians are very leery of, and which the Athabascans in particular dread. Also, the shape-changing power can only be won through committing one or more ritual murders.
Wow.
That's not a life way I'm terribly conversant with. I'd say even a lot of the most modern Navajos feel at least a certain thrill of dread about skinwalkers. Just as atheists raised amid Christian society sometimes harbor secret fears of hell.
I'm familiar with that phenomenon.
Now, there is someone who might be able to expand on what little I can tell you about the Navajo wolf phenomenon. I can put you in touch with Dr. Yves Michel of the World Health Organization. He spent the past couple of years among the native peoples of Arizona and New Mexico studying Southwest Indian health issues on behalf of the UN, particularly mental health issues. He's a psychiatrist as well as holding a doctorate in cultural anthropology. A very erudite man. Although I have to caution you, he can be difficult.
Thanks for the warning.
He does, however, like to talk about his areas of interest. In particular, he's made an intensive study of the skinwalker belief complex. While he has yet to publish any papers, he's passed drafts around to many friends and colleagues that I understand have created quite a stir.
Wait, I think I've heard of him.
In fact, Anya was pretty sure she'd seen his work on skinwalkers discussed on alt.archaeology, a website she frequently visited that was devoted to discussions of fringe archaeology. While she considered herself a stout skeptic, she also felt she owed it to her discipline to maintain an open mind, hence her continuing attention to the outer limits of archaeological research. It was entirely possible that among the piles of printouts stacked on the sofa or coffee table of her Brooklyn loft apartment was actually a copy of Dr. Michel's draft paper. She spent so little time there these days, she couldn't keep track of everything. Dr. Watson took out one of her own business cards and wrote Dr. Michel's phone number and email address on the back of it. As she did so, Sally came racing back with Eowyn loping behind her. The girl plopped herself on the cold cement bench near her mother. The lab lay down beside her, panting and grinning. Anya found herself studying the girl, Sally noticed.
What? Do I have a booger?
Sally!
Dr. Watson passed the card to Anya.
No, I'm sorry. It's
sorry.
Rude to stare. You just look familiar somehow.
Wait till I'm famous. I'm gonna be a superheroine.
Oh, we plains people tend to have active imaginations. A cultural thing, I think.
She reached out to tousle the girl's hair. Sally endured it a moment, then leaped up and went dashing off once more with Eowyn in happy pursuit.
I guess you wonder why a middle-aged woman has such a young daughter. She was the outcome of an attempt to save a marriage. And like most such attempts, it didn't work. I try not to talk about that where she can hear. I hate keeping things from her, but it's a terrible responsibility to lay on a child.
Light began to dawn on Anya.
She wouldn't have an older brother, would she?
Yes. His name's John. He's 14 years older than she is. They love each other, but there are limits to how close they can be across that kind of gap.
I think I know why she looks familiar. Please forgive my asking a highly personal question, but you wouldn't happen to have been married to Lieutenant Ten Bears, would you?
Yes.
So that's why he recommended I talk to you.
I'd like to think a degree of respect for my competence influenced him. We do respect each other, even if we're miles apart in most of our viewpoints on things. I'm a leftist, if not an entirely respectable one. He's a right-winger, a total gung-ho patriot. I guess that's what you'd expect from a war hero and lifelong cop. We still feel affection for each other, too. The divorce was amicable. Of course, you couldn't say that for the last few years of our marriage.
Wait, your son's name is John. Johnny?
Why, yes. He served with the Army Rangers in Iraq and Afghanistan. When he came home, he was changed.
And now he's leader of the Iron Horse People Motorcycle Club?
He's a community activist who prefers to think of himself as an outlaw biker. Not that I altogether approve of what he's trying to achieve. Sometimes he seems way too much like the militia crazies of the 90s. But I'm much calmer about his activities than my ex-husband is.
A barking dog broke the thread of conversation. Anya and Watson looked across the large park. The sun had set. The air grew chilly, with only a blood-red band on the horizon and reddish undertints on a few clouds. The evening filled the hollows of the park like velvet. Down in the bottom of the depression, between the slope and the picnic table, stood a hill. Sally was digging her heels in to restrain Eowyn, apparently newly leashed. The adolescent lab barked furiously toward the top of the far hill. The yellow pup didn't sound floppy-friendly now, even 100 feet away. Anya could see the hackles standing up on her neck. She was in serious guardian mode, with only Sally's determination keeping her from launching a preemptive attack on something she perceived as immediately dangerous. Following the line of the dog's fury, Anya felt the hair at her own nape rise. Silhouetted on the hill crest was the broad head and pointed ears of what appeared to be a wolf. Otherwise, it was indistinct, a black shadow against the twilight.
Why is Eowyn so mad at that Malamute, or whatever it is? She's usually so friendly with everybody, dogs as well as humans.
Anya was up and running down the slope. As she came up to Sally, the girl finished reeling in the leash, grabbed the bristling Eowyn's collar, and sat down with her legs braced.
You're not going anywhere, girl. What's gotten into you?
The wolf-like head vanished as Anya started uphill toward it. She wasn't sure what she intended. If the animal attacked her, and she had to use her sword to defend herself, she would have many, many questions to answer that she frankly never wanted to face. When she reached the top of the hill, she saw no sign of the creature. She spotted a dog-like shadow flitting between a couple of the houses across the street on the park's other side. She got an eerie sensation down her spine again as it turned and looked directly at her. Then it vanished. Anya stood and watched for half a minute, her heart pounding in her chest far more than the brief exertion, even at a mile's altitude, would account for. She didn't see the animal again. She decided she was not going to go tramping around through people's yards, hunting for what would almost certainly turn out to be somebody's stray husky. Anya turned and walked back down toward where Watson had joined her daughter, kneeling beside Eowyn. Both stroked the animal.
Why did I get so worked up about a dog? I shouldn't let myself be so suggestible. It's fatigue. Physical and emotional fatigue. It has to be.
The tall plainswoman stood. Eowyn had settled down. She wagged her tail and grinned at Anya, inviting her to admire her heroism. Anya bent down and petted her.
You're a good watchdog.
Was it just a dog, then?
Anya looked at her sharply.
Why? What else would it be?
Watson turned her eyes away from Anya's. She seemed shaken.
Thank you for your willingness to protect my daughter. We'd better go now.
Dr. Michel. Bonjour, entrez honneur.
Anya shook hands with the psychiatrist. His face was pinched.
Please, Americans should not try to speak French. It is almost a form of cultural imperialism to butcher the language so.
I think I see what Dr. Watson meant about him being difficult.
Anya wasn't exactly unaccustomed to arrogance from the French, although they could also be a lovely, charming people. This man definitely pushed the envelope of rudeness, though. He was short, a head shorter than Anya, dressed in a white shirt with the sleeves rolled up, khaki pants, hiking boots. He had broad shoulders and a marathon runner's build. Despite the fact his close-cropped hair was steely, and his resume, which Anya had looked up online the night before, said he was in his early 50s, his narrow features were quite youthful, relatively unmarked. Surprisingly so, given a tan of apparent long standing. He wasn't what she would call a handsome man, but his appearance and manner suggested a kestrel. And that dark tan made his eyes, of a blue so pale as to be almost silver, look striking, almost to the point of eeriness.
At least I lucked out when it came to tracking him down.
He was currently working in Sandia Pueblo. It formed basically the northern boundary of Albuquerque, stretching from the river to the foothills of the Sandia Mountains and north to within a few miles of the town of Bernalillo. For whatever reason, Dr. Michel had chosen to meet Anya late in the afternoon at a scenic lookout spot in the foothills. When she arrived at the appointed spot, a little before the agreed-upon time, as was her cautious custom, she found the doctor already waiting for her, leaning with arms folded against a vehicle that was apparently his mobile living quarters. It looked to Anya like the front end of a Toyota pickup mated to a body, like a panel van customized into an RV. She wondered if the UN shelled out to build it, or if he found it somewhere used. It bore the markings of many miles.
What can you tell me about the skinwalker phenomenon, Dr. Michel?
What with one thing or another, she figured the best course was to get this interview over with as quickly as possible.
First, you must have a basic understanding of the Navajo witch. He or she is a follower of the witchcraft way. The Athabaskan of the Southwest fear ghosts more than anything. Not unnaturally, they associate ghosts with corpses, of whom they consequently feel a peculiarly poignant terror. They likewise fear owls, whom they suspect to be ghosts, and also of serving as spies and servitors to witches. And the basic reason for this fear is that contamination by ghosts or the dead can cause a wasting ghost sickness or corpse sickness, which can bring about decline, decrepitude, and even eventual death to the victim. And make no mistake, people have died of ghost sickness. They die of it today, they will into the future, unless the white man succeeds in finally murdering the native culture, or the entire planet. It is a phenomenon like pointing the bone in Haiti.
A psychosomatic effect.
He sneered. His fine, mobile features, the cheeks and chin lightly stubbled in silver, lent themselves well to it, she had to admit.
Does it comfort you to think so? The symptoms in such cases are real, and so, as I say, are the deaths. Call that psychosomatic, if you like. The most dangerous medium of the ghost sickness is corpse powder. Human bodies dried and ground. The corpse powder is assure you this matter is deadly serious. These people, who are as human as you or me, take it with literal deadly seriousness. There exists today a small community, which I will not name, whose population consists entirely of Navajos believed to be witches and their descendants. They went into exile rather than face punishment. The tribe allowed them to do so, rather than face the White Eye's retribution for punishing them according to the ancient ways. I have gone among these exiled witches, spoken to them. When they and other Navajos encounter one another, each pretends not to recognize the other. Otherwise, there would be blood.
Do they still practice witchcraft?
Some say they do. Some say they do not. Who is to say who lies and who tells the truth?
Wouldn't they be natural suspects as the source for our killer?
They have learned to survive by keeping their heads down. To fly under the White Eye's radar, as you might say. They chose to accept permanent partition from their clans, from their sacred earth, which are as much a part of them as their bones and flesh and blood. If they made that sacrifice, would they jeopardize the safety they bought at such terrible cost?
Dr. Michel, 15 people, including a very dear friend of mine, have died at the hands of one or more apparent Navajo wolves. I think the last thing you need to worry about is whether I take the phenomenon seriously.
Bon. Now, the most terrible form of witch is the skinwalker. It is the most extreme and difficult path of the witchcraft way. It requires rituals even more horrific and forbidden than the less esoteric witchcraft. Needless to say, murder, blood, and corpse powder figure prominently in its attainment.
Of course.
By this point, Anya felt the need for a bit of flippancy to save her sanity and damn the risks of this uptight man's overly sharpened tongue. If she hadn't seen the photographs of the victims, if her friend hadn't virtually died in her arms, she would not be reacting so strongly to Michelle's catalog of horrors, no matter how much relish he recited them with. She was vulnerable. He seemed to sense that and enjoy taking advantage.
The skinwalker is said to have many fearful gifts. The power to read thoughts. The ability to imitate the voice of any person or animal. Sometimes impersonating loved ones to lure victims to their doom. Some stories even credit them with being able to steal another's body by gazing deeply into their eyes. And, of course, they have the power to assume animal form, predominantly, though not restricted to, that of a wolf. Hence, the common appellation Navajo Wolf. Some others assert that they assume a sort of hybrid human-animal form. In these altered shapes, or skins, they are said to possess strength, speed, and resistance to damage far in excess of either human or animal.
I see. That would be a pretty formidable package.
Most likely, of course, you are dealing with a mere poseur. An imitator, a copycat, you might say. If you are dealing with a real skinwalker, you are in very grave trouble indeed.
Define real in this context, Dr. Michel, please.
A skeptic, eh? Very well. When I say a real skinwalker, I mean a person who has undergone the grueling, horrific, and largely illegal rituals prescribed for becoming a Navajo wolf. Such an individual would likely possess above-average intelligence and almost superhuman determination. Indeed, as you would know had you read my paper, which I have circulated on a limited basis in preliminary form, I theorize that the witch, particularly the skinwalker, constitutes a peculiarly Navajo life way for what we would term a sociopath. Such people in other cultures are known for high intelligence, resourcefulness, and a complete lack of conventional inhibitions. They can behave quite obsessively in pursuit of their goals, including developing their skills to an extraordinarily high level.
I read your paper, Doctor. I found a copy online last night. I wanted to get what insight I could from you in person.
If the fact she'd read his paper mollified the French psychiatrist, he hid it well.
If a true skinwalker is responsible for these killings, I blame the corruption of Western influence, unremitting violence in popular culture and everyday life, and, of course, materialist, consumerist capitalism, which corrupts all it touches.
Consumerism?
His twists of logic were starting to make Anya's head swim, the way his stories turned her stomach.
In line with that understanding, I have formed an alternative hypothesis. While traditional Navajo wolves renounce humanity and actively embrace evil, I have come to suspect that certain other aspirants to the witchcraft way undertake to, in effect, sacrifice themselves for the good of the people. That being, of course, what the Navajo call themselves. They embrace the appurtenances of evil in order to derive the power to do good. In this, they make themselves the opposite of sociopaths, although their actions are almost impossible to discern from each other. Whereas the sociopathic serial murderer kills without conscience because he lacks empathy, this other being becomes a killer on a mission, who kills because his conscience drives him to do so. He averts his empathy from his victims because he is driven by empathy for those whom he believes he serves. Once many psychologists used the term psychopath for such a one, the conscience-driven killer, as opposed to the conscienceless sociopath. The terms have long been conflated in the public awareness, such as it is, and in any event thoroughly obfuscated by the official professional jargon.
Thank you, Dr. Michel.
Anya jumped in before he could plunge any deeper into what seemed likely to be another of his numerous wells of disregard.
Have you thought of approaching the authorities with your expertise on the subject? Your theories might prove helpful towards solving these crimes.
Oh, you must understand, Miss Creed. Fascinating as I naturally find this case, my interest remains purely scientific. As for whether they apprehend the killer or not, I give not a fig.
He made a dismissive flick of his fingertips.
So far as I am concerned, archaeologists are nothing more than despoilers of native peoples and violators of their tombs. The more the skinwalker kills of them, the better.
With maximum effort, Anya controlled herself.
I'm an archaeologist, Dr. Michel.
So? It is on your soul, not mine. A good day to you, Miss Creed. I shall not talk to you again. I have important work to do.
Still steaming over her encounter with the arrogant French psychiatrist, Anya drove back the way she had come. At Tramway Road, she turned south toward I-40. She intended to return to Lawton straight away. She had decided she'd been away from Comanche country long enough for things to settle down sufficiently. It was after dark when she stopped at a rest area near the Texas border. The wind blew down the plains with little to hinder it. It buffeted her rental car and chilled her right through as soon as she stepped out. Though unheated, the restroom seemed a sanctuary of warmth and calm. When she finished her business, she opened the stall door to find two men with their faces painted black awaiting her. The one on her left wore an indigo hoodie and what looked like sweatpants. The one on her right, a black windbreaker and pants. Both wore black athletic shoes. The bareheaded one had his dense black hair slicked back. They showed no weapons. She was not naive enough to assume that meant they didn't have them. Most likely, they didn't feel a need to display them. Reading the intent in her eyes, they fell back a step. Sadly, they talked themselves out of doing the sensible thing, which was simply to walk away and leave Anya Creed alone.
Dog soldiers, I'm guessing.
Anya stepped back into the stall. It gave her, she reckoned, maximum choice of engagement ground should they attack. If she thought mobility might serve her best, she had the larger restroom to move about in. If she wanted to ensure they could only come at her one at a time, she could retreat fully back into the stall and accept the restrictions on her own scope of movement. And if at any time the opportunity presented itself, she'd bolt out the door and be gone with the ice-nasty plains wind that beat and boomed outside.
You shouldn't think so much. You should just leave.
Indian people don't want you here.
You should turn around, drive back to Albuquerque, get on a plane, and fly away home. You don't belong here, sticking your long nose in where it don't belong.
The bad grammar sounded as forced as their accents. By their builds and the general shapes of their faces, which was all she could make out for the paint and the not very good illumination, she figured they really were Indians, probably Comanche. But they seemed to be playing a role, and rather too hard at that.
Thanks for the advice. I'll give it the consideration it deserves. Now, if you'll excuse me.
Anya started to walk between them.
Not so fast!
The man on her left grabbed her upper arm. Anya spun smartly into him. Two quick jabs left the attacker on his knees with a broken nose and blood pouring through his fingers.
Hey!
His partner had already started grabbing for her right shoulder. If the object lesson provided by his buddy made an impression, it came too late for him. She wheeled back into him and swung him face first into the stout floor-to-ceiling upright that anchored the stall's front. Anya gave him a phoenix-eye fist, first knuckle extended, in the right kidney just to get his mind right. The other guy was game, on his knees, still trying futilely to staunch the blood from his broken nose with one hand. He groped for Anya with the other as she turned to go.
Hi-ya!
She gave him a sidekick that drove his other hand into his broken nose and snapped his head back against the other metal upright. He collapsed like an empty grain sack.
Good evening, gentlemen. No need to get up. The pleasure was all mine.
Mind if I sit down?
Anya Creed's blood froze. The voice belonged to Johnny Tenbears, chieftain of the outlaw Iron Horse People Motorcycle Club. She kept herself from flicking her eyes left and right like a frightened rabbit to look for other threats. Instead, she softened and widened the focus of her eyes. It showed her only the blurry shapes of the diners who had been there a moment before, when she was eating in peace, alone.
Do I have a choice?
We always have a choice.
Johnny sat down across from her.
Just doesn't always make a difference.
A mere quarter mile from her motel on the southwest outskirts of Lawton, not even a decent warm-up for long-legged Anya Creed, the Oklahoma Rose Cafe served a great breakfast. Anya regarded the outlaw biker lord across the formica tabletop.
How are you walking these days?
Gingerly.
Good.
Anya's server turned up. The tall, good-looking black woman in early middle age had light skin and straight auburn hair wound up on her head in something that irresistibly reminded Anya of soft swirl ice cream.
Johnny Tenbears, what do you think you're doing showing your face around here? This is a respectable establishment.
Yeah, well, I'm the exception to the rule, Ruth. Coffee, please.
Ruth went away, shaking her head.
Don't even try turning that charm on me.
Wouldn't think of it, Ms. Creed.
You know my name.
He shrugged.
Turned out Billy Whitebird, my head wrench, is a big fan. He recognized you about an hour after you blew out of the bad medicine.
Really?
He leaned forward and clasped his hands on the tabletop before him. It was a gesture of such schoolboy earnestness she almost laughed out loud. He had good hands, she couldn't help noticing. Big, strong, showing the calluses and scars of hard work despite his relatively few years. Only a few more than hers.
You and my people kind of got off on the wrong foot. I apologize for that. Personally, and on behalf of my club.
Whatever. Your family's just full of coincidences, isn't it?
He raised a brow.
I mean, you turning up like this.
You're watched every moment you're in Indian country. And not all eyes are friendly. And, what was that about my family?
The way your dad turned up in his cruiser on the county road north of the Bad Medicine the other night. To pick an example, totally at random.
He's wired into the nation, too. Not much happens in Troop G territory he doesn't find out about.
I got that impression.
We wondered where you'd got to. Nasty night out.
Yes, it was.
I'd like to try my best to correct some misunderstandings you may have picked up along the way. The Iron Horse People Motorcycle Club is not your enemy.
You put on a good act.
Anyway, first, you blundered into a place we feel very territorial about. Second, you perfectly fit the profile of the sort of person who should not be wandering into random roadhouses in western Oklahoma. And I don't mean just Indian bars or outlaw biker bars or both. Or, well, at first glance, you seem to fit the profile. I guess you showed how wrong that was. Turned out, unlike your normal tenderfoot tourist, you know how to handle yourself.
I like to think so.
Plus, my father may have fueled some fires here I'd like to tamp down. We are Indian secessionists. We're upfront about that. It's our whole reason for being. What we aren't is racist.
Oh, really?
Please, Miss Creed, hear me out. Yes, we picked on you because you were white meat. And would have been meat for real if you went through the wrong door in Comanche County. You still could turn out that way, no matter how tough you are. Our reflex first thought was that you needed a good scare to keep you from making a mistake that could seriously cost you.
Why would I believe that?
To start with, we let you get out alive.
Anya froze with a forkful of eggs partway to her mouth.
All right. Point taken.
Our grievance is with the Great White Father and his hirelings, whatever color they are. We want nothing to do with Washington. Take nothing from it, give nothing to it. That's what we're about. Self-determination above everything else.
Your mother said you had a lot of ideas in common with the old militia types.
My mother?
Anya grinned. Despite the all-knowing native act, he could be caught by surprise after all.
I met her in Albuquerque. Your father sent me to her for a cultural background briefing. He didn't tell me she was associated with the ubiquitous Ten Bears clan either.
Okay, so my dad and I aren't always as dissimilar as we'd maybe both like to believe. How is she?
Fine. So's your sister.
His grin showed nothing but genuine pleasure.
Thanks. We don't always keep in touch.
The smile faded.
Please, hear what I tell you. It's not just that there are some people, whether Indians or shit-kickers in these parts, who are inclined to prey on lone young women, especially ones as pretty as you are. Just fact, ma'am. No familiarity implied. It's that this is a very dangerous time and place for any outsiders, especially inquisitive white eyes. There's a war going on. One that's the more nasty for being underground.
Your father told me there was...
And the Dog Society.
Bad blood between you and...
Saw some of them the other night.
Maybe.
Please don't play coy with me, Miss Creed. This isn't bad blood. It's war. I've seen war. I know what it looks and feels and smells like.
I know.
He spoke like someone who did know war. Those who only experienced it at second hand seldom understood about the smell.
I'm talking about midnight disappearances, decomposed bodies found in washes, a body count nobody talks about, and it keeps on rising.
She couldn't doubt the truth of what he said. She was surprised, though, by how much Johnny's ever-helpful father hadn't told her.
The Dog Society were originally Cheyenne. A lot of them live around here, too.
I know the history part. Your mother filled me in. It's current events I'm not too clear on.
Well, okay. The Dog Soldiers, 21st Century Edition. A few actual Cheyennes belong, as well as some Kiowa. Most of them are young Comanches. They are racists, who don't like white eyes worth spit. They're hardcore traditionalists, or what they like to imagine Numenu traditions are anyway. They really believe, and I can't emphasize this enough, that as the American Empire weakens, the time approaches when they can throw off the white eyes' yoke and rule.
Really? And that differs from your philosophy, how?
Fair question. We, the Iron Horse people, don't want to force anybody to do anything but let us alone. We only want to rule ourselves. Yes, we think the Empire's going down too. You've got eyes. Don't you see it?
Let's stick with the sales pitch for your philosophy.
The Dogs are eager to kill anybody whose feet stray from their very narrow path. We fight them, yes, to contain them, to try to keep them from hurting too many people, or setting a wildfire that could consume the whole Comanche nation. My father will never believe it, but we're the good guys.
You expect me to believe it?
It's the truth. Like any gift, what you choose to do with it once I give it to you is your business.
Anya nodded. He sat back, cocked his head, and regarded her appraisingly. Without warning, the window exploded inward toward them. With rattlesnake strike speed, Johnny Ten Bears reached over the table, grabbed Anya's wrist, and she hoisted another forkful and yanked her from the booth. As she cleared the table, he pulled her toward him hard. Shards of glass cascaded across the red vinyl seats of the booth, over the table, and onto the floor. Anya slid past Johnny on the slick floor. Yellow and white chintz curtains flapped as the wind blew through the shot-out windows.
No, stay down!
Anya writhed in Johnny's grasp. She pushed up on all fours, then ran, bent over, through more broken glass toward the door. Given that somebody was spraying and praying, probably from a moving car, a quick glance outside would expose her to little additional risk. Instead, when she took a 3-second look out the door, she saw a Junker Brown sedan screaming around a corner, with the long black barrels and distinctive ribbed foregrips of M16s sticking out the windows. She glanced around to see if there were follow-up vehicles or gunmen approaching on foot. She saw nothing threatening. When Anya turned around, she saw Johnny going quickly from customer to customer, making sure no one was badly hurt. She started doing the same. The diners had all gotten onto the floor and laid low with no apparent panic. They were picking themselves up now. Ruth's soft-serve hairdo popped up from behind the counter.
Oh! What the hell was that?
Dog soldier's social call.
The bullets missed everyone. An elderly woman and a trucker had suffered cuts on their faces. They seemed pretty calm, considering.
Why would somebody want to go and do something like that? What's the world coming to?
Anya turned to frown at Johnny.
The Dog Society plays for keeps.
Are you sure those were dog soldiers?
Do you think I'm dumb enough to sit here waiting for my own people to take a shot at you from a moving car just to prove some point? You can't be sure of hitting what you aim at, blasting full rock and roll from a moving vehicle, so you can't be sure of missing either, can you?
You're right. So, more coincidence.
Not really. Somebody saw me and dropped a dime. Remember what I told you about life in Indian country.
He raised his head and frowned in concentration as if sniffing the air.
This place is about to get even less healthy for me, so I'm gone. Think about what I told you.
I will.
Johnny tossed a few bills on an interior table and left, moving with purpose but no haste. Anya stood and watched as he forked his big red and buff bike. Anya surveyed the scene. Ruth had mustered the kitchen staff, who were all unharmed, to see to the customers. They seemed to have the situation well in hand, with no serious injuries suffered. Anya found a safe chair and sat to await the arrival of the law. To her surprise, the first to arrive on the scene weren't Lawton cops or Comanche County officers, not even the highway patrol, but a pair of gleaming gray sedans full of trim young Indian men in business suits with short haircuts. Some of them drew handguns and moved out of sight, evidently to check the rear exits to the building. Three entered the diner. The obvious leader was a man in his late 20s who was built like a power lifter. He stood a moment with hands on hips, pooching out the tails of his suit coat, frowning over the scene. Then he approached Anya.
You're Anya Creed?
The man flipped open a leather case to display a shield that read, Comanche Nation Law Enforcement.
Yes.
I'm pleased to meet you. I'm Georgia Bell, Chief Inspector of the Comanche Nation's new Special Investigative Unit. What happened here?
Abel's two companions drew handguns and went back to check the kitchens and the back rooms. Anya told him. Since the other people in the diner would tell the investigators about her companion, she told him the truth. Most of it, anyway. She saw no point in mentioning the bad medicine. After all, he was concerned with what just happened here. Abel started frowning at mention of Johnny Ten Bears. His frown only dug itself deeper into his round, slightly coarse face as she gave him an edited account of their conversation.
You're a very lucky woman, Miss Creed. John Ten Bears is a dangerous man.
I'm sure he is, Chief Inspector. But wasn't it the Dog Society that shot at me?
He scowled even deeper. His men came out of the back shaking their heads, nobody hiding there. He nodded briskly to them, and they began moving among the witnesses, asking questions of their own.
The Dog Society are basically radical activists. Sometimes they let their zeal for social justice run away with them. While I won't rule out that some dog hotheads might have been responsible for the shooting, since Johnny Ten Bears is a bitter and brutal enemy, I think most likely our shooters were disaffected Iron Horses. They're a gang of violent criminals, Miss Tree. There's nothing they're not capable of.
Except stabbing or shooting me when they had their chance, and I even gave them a halfway decent excuse, Anya thought. Interesting. Then again, Abel wouldn't be the first cop with a hatred for bikers. The chief inspector spoke like a college-educated man, closer to an academic than a stereotypical Midwestern law enforcement man, or even Lieutenant Tom Tenbears, who wouldn't settle for being anybody's stereotype. He was surface pleasant, at least, slick in a way that belied his powerful appearance. With a smile, he quickly lost points with his next advice.
I really urge you to go home to New York and leave the investigation to professionals, Miss Creed.
I'm a journalist, as well as an archaeologist. I've done consulting work for law enforcement before. I won't interfere in your investigation.
You misunderstand me. I only have your safety at heart. It might not be going too far to suggest you may be a marked woman. Ten Bears is a criminal, probably even a terrorist. He's also a punk. He's always been a punk and a wannabe.
Anya shied back from him ever so slightly.
Please forgive my vehemence. I've known John since we were kids. It makes me angry that he put you and these other innocent people at risk from such potentially deadly violence.
I was afraid I'd find you here.
Both Anya and Abel turned, the latter frowning again.
Lieutenant Tenbears!
The stocky highway patrol officer had stepped aside to clear the way for emergency crews bustling in to examine the wounded. He stood with his thumbs hooked in the front of his belt. He didn't look as cheerful as usual.
Morning, Anya. Mr. Abel.
Abel nodded shortly.
Lieutenant?
The air temperature dropped a few degrees from where the nasty plane's wind had already pushed it. Anya could practically see the testosterone swimming in midair like dust motes. Departmental rivalry in action, she thought. No doubt complicated by the fact of Johnny Ten Bears. Ruth rushed up.
Tom! That crazy son of yours was in here. He brings trouble with him wherever he goes.
Tell me something I don't know, Ruth. Everybody okay?
Aside from a few nicks and scratches, nothing they won't get over. I sure hope Mrs. Kubica's insurance covers this mess, though.
Ruth scrubbed her hands in her apron, shaking her head.
Lucky thing those so-and-sos couldn't shoot for Diddley.
Amen.
Other troopers came in with evidence techs and began taking statements.
Miss Creed, I'd like you to come back to the barracks and give me a statement.
Abel opened his mouth.
Of course, Lieutenant.
Turning to Abel, Anya extended a hand. He gave it a firm, if perfunctory, shake.
I appreciate your solicitude, Mr. Abel. Goodbye.
I'll want a copy of any statements the witnesses make.
Send the request through channel, George. You know the drill.